The third point and next subheading is Eliot's Practical Criticism, Shakespeare's Hamlet, Milton, the Metaphysical Poets, 18th Century Poetry and Poets, Matthew Arnold, Eliot's Critical Methods, Assessment of His Practical Criticism. Eliot's critical essays may broadly be divided into two categories: essays dealing with the nature and function of criticism, poetry and drama, that is, his theoretical criticism, and second, essays dealing with a number of important authors and their works. Such essays constitute his practical criticism and throw valuable light in his critical methods. We would first quote significant passages from Eliot's Practical Criticism and then examine his critical methods in the light of these passages. The other subheading, Hamlet, Objective Correlative. Eliot's essay on Hamlet is the finest example of what may be called his destructive or iconoclastic criticism. He writes, "The only way of expressing emotion in the form of art is by finding an objective correlative, in other words, a set of objects, a situation, a chain of events which shall be the formula of the particular emotion, such that when the external facts which must terminate in sensory experience are given, the emotion is immediately evoked." If you examine any of Shakespeare's more successful tragedies, you will find this exact equivalence. You will find that the state of mind of Lady Macbeth walking in her sleep has been communicated to you by a skillful accumulation of imagined sensory impressions. The words of Macbeth on hearing of his wife's death strike us as if, given the sequence of events, these words were automatically released by the last event in the series. The artistic inevitability lies in this complete adequacy of the external to the emotion, and this is precisely what is deficient in Hamlet. Hamlet is dominated by an emotion which is inexpressible because it is in excess of the facts as they appear. And the supposed identity of Hamlet with his author is genuine to this point, that Hamlet's bafflement at the absence of objective equivalent to his feelings is a prolongation of the bafflement of his creator in the face of his artistic problem. Hamlet is up against the difficulty that his disgust is occasioned by his mother, Hamlet is up against the difficulty that his disgust is occasioned by his mother, but that his mother is not an adequate equivalent for it. His disgust envelops and exceeds her. It is thus a feeling which he cannot understand, he cannot objectify it, and it therefore remains to poison life and obstruct action. None of the possible actions can satisfy it, and nothing that Shakespeare can do with the plot can express Hamlet for him. And it must be noticed that the very nature of the problem precludes objective equivalence. To have heightened the criminality of Gertrude would have been to provide the formula for a totally different emotion in Hamlet. It is just because her character is so negative and insignificant that she arouses in Hamlet the feeling which she is incapable of representing. Hamlet has been universally admired as a great work of art and has been a source of pleasure to countless generations of theater-goers, but Eliot regards it as an artistic failure. He compares the play with the other tragedies of dramatists and finds it lacking in objective correlative. The disgust of Hamlet is in excess to the guilt of his mother. However, the play has reasserted its immortality despite Eliot's disparagement. The exact reveals Eliot as a master of the language as well as his powerful gift of phrasing. It is here that he has, for the first time, used the phrase objective correlative, a phrase which had since attained wide popularity. The next subheading is Milton. Another fine instance of Eliot's destructive criticism is his essay on Milton. Many people will agree that a man may be a great artist and yet have a bad influence. There is more of Milton's influence in the badness of the bad words of the 18th century than of anybody else. He certainly did more harm than Dryden and Pope, and perhaps a good deal of the obloquy, obloquy, and perhaps a good deal of obloquy which has fallen on these two poets, especially the latter, because of their influence, ought to be transferred to Milton. But to put the matter simply in terms of bad influence is not necessarily to bring a serious charge, because a good deal of the responsibility, when we state the problem in these terms, may devolve on the 18th century poets themselves for being such bad poets that they were incapable of being influenced except for ill. There is a good deal more to the charge against Milton than this, and it appears a good deal more serious if we affirm that Milton's poetry could only be an influence for the worse upon any poet whatever. It is more serious also if affirm that Milton's bad influence may be traced much farther than the 18th century and much farther than upon bad poets. If we say that it was an influence against which we still have to struggle. Eliot regards Milton as a bad influence for a number of reasons. First, he lacked visual imagination. Secondly, he wrote English like a dead language. Thirdly, his syntax is involved and theoretical. Fourthly, he employs long lists of proper names to describe space. And lastly, his style is not a classical style in that it is not the elevation of a common style. Eliot could appreciate the artistic merits of Milton. His purpose in stretching his faults was to liberate English poets and poetry from the harmful influence of Milton. It may be said to his credit that, though much has since been written in praise of Milton, the specific charges that he has brought against the Puritan poet have not been answered so far. However, Eliot is perverse when he compares Milton with Joyce, for there can be no comparison at all between writers so widely different from each other. One cannot help feeling that most of his dislike of Milton results from personal prejudices, religious and political. The metaphysical poets. Eliot's essay on metaphysical poets Donne, Marvell, Vaughan, Cole, etc. is a remarkable piece of criticism, for it did much to bring about a revival of interest in these poets of early 17th century. Tennyson and Browning are poets, and they think, but they do not feel their thought as immediately as the odor of a rose. A thought to Dune was an experience. It modified his sensibility. When a poet's mind is perfectly equipped for its work, it is constantly amalgamating disparate experiences. The ordinary man's experience is chaotic, irregular, fragmentary. The latter falls in love or reads Spinoza, and these two experiences have nothing to do with each other or with the noise of the typewriter or the smell of cooking. In the mind of the poet, these experiences are always forming new wholes. We may express the difference by the following theory. The poets of the 17th century, the successor of the dramatist of the 16th, possessed a mechanism of sensibility which could devour any kind of experience. They are simple or artificial, difficult or fantastic as their predecessors were, no less or more than Dante. Guido Cavalcanti, Guiscali or Cino. In the 17th century, a dissociation of sensibility set in from which we have never recovered, and this dissociation, as is natural, was aggravated by the influence of the two most powerful poets of the century, Milton and Dryden. Each of these men performed certain poetic function so magnificently well that the magnitude of the effect concealed the absence of others. The language went on and in some respects improved. The best works of Collins, Gray, Johnson, and even Goldsmith satisfies some of our fastidious demands better than that of Dune or Marvel or King. But while the language becomes more refined, the feeling becomes more crude. The feeling, the sensibility expressed in the country churchyard, to say nothing of Tennyson and Browning, is cruder than that of the choir mistress. The second effect of influence of Milton and Dryden followed from the first and was therefore slow in manifestation. The sentimental age began early in the 18th century and continued. The poets revolted against the ratiocinative, the descriptive. They thought and felt by fits. Unbalanced, they reflected. In one or two passages of Shelley's Triumph of Life, in the second Hyperion, there are traces of a struggle towards unification of sensibility. But Keats and Shelley died, and Tennyson and Browning remained. After this brief exposition of a theory, too brief perhaps to carry conviction, we may ask what would have the fate of metaphysicals had the current of poetry descended in a direct line from them, as it descended in a direct line to them. They would not certainly be classified as metaphysical. The possible interests of a poet are unlimited. The more intelligence he is, the better. The more intelligent he is, the more likely that he will have interests. Our only condition is that he turns them into poetry and not merely meditate on them poetically. A philosophical theory which has entered into poetry is established, for its truth or falsity in one sense ceases to matter, and its truth in another sense is proved. The poets in question have, like other poets, various faults, but they were, at best, engaged in the task of trying to find verbal equivalent for states of mind and feeling, and this means both that they are more mature and that they were better than later poets of certainly not less literary ability. It is in this essay that Eliot has for the first time used the phrase dissociation of sensibility, a cliche which ever since has had considerable influence on the course of English literature. Eliot's power of phrasing is displayed at its best in the use of such memorable expressions as "they do not feel their thought as immediately as the odor of a rose." We also get an exposition of his theory of poetic process. The act of creation is not an expression of the poet's emotion. It is rather an act of organization of different and disparate expressions of the poet's emotion. It is rather an act of organization of different and disparate experiences into a single whole. Donne and the other metaphysical poets are compared with Tennyson, Browning, Dryden, Johnson, and a host of other English poets. But the purpose of this comparison is not to determine good or bad, but to elucidate and interpret certain distinctive features of their work. Similar is his use of quotations. The essay represents the triumph of Eliot as a critic. It is a classic both of English prose and English criticism. Then the next subheading is 18th century poetry. His essay on 18th century poetry and poets is equally illuminating. The 18th century in English verse is not, after Pope, Swift, Prior, and Gray, an age of courtly verse. He seems more like an age of retired country clergymen and schoolmasters. It is cursed with a pastoral convention. Collins' eclogues are bad enough, and those of Sandstone consummatedly dull and a ruminative mind. And it is intolerably poetic. Instead of working out the proper form for its matter, when it has any, and informing verse with prose virtues, it merely applies the magniloquence of Milton or the neatness of Pope to matter which is wholly unprepared for it, so that what the writers save to say always appears surprised at the way in which they choose to say so. In this rural, pastoral, meditative age, Johnson is the most aligned figure. Goldsmith is more a poet of his time, with his melting sentiment just saved by the precision of his language. But Johnson remains a townsman, if certainly not a courtier, a student of mankind, not of natural history, a great prose writer with no tolerance of swans and milkmaids. He has more in common in spirit with Crabbe than with any of his contemporaries. At the same time, he is the last Augustine. He is in no way an imitator of Dryden or Pope, very close to them in idiom. He gives his verse a wholly personal stamp. In one way, Johnson goes back to an earlier tradition, however inferior, as satires, Maidstone's, or even Hell's may be of Johnson's. They are surely much nearer to the spirit of Juvenal than are those of Dryden or Pope. Dryden is, in the modern sense, humorous and witty. Pope is, in the modern sense, witty, thought, not humorous. Johnson, neither humorous nor witty in this sense, has yet the proper wit of poetry, as the 17th century and Augustine is, had it also. The essay, too, shows Eliot's gift of phrasing at its happiest. He has the courage to stand up against established opinion that the 18th century was an age of prose and reason, and express the contrary opinion that the age was too poetic. He remarks on Dryden and Johnson reveal his penetrating intellect and his power of analysis. He is not carried away by the popular wind, but judges for himself on the basis of the facts that are before him.